The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, the new voice in bodybuilding podcasting, presented by Max Gear. Welcome to Muscle Minds, Episode 1. I am here with Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Jordan, how you doing, man?
I'm very well, thank you.
Awesome. Scott, how are you?
Likewise, good.
It's
warm.
Yes, lucky you. I've got snow over here. What's the weather like over there, Jordan?
Pretty mild. It's fairly cold today, but nothing crazy. No extremes as of yet.
It sounds better than we've got snow and then more snow in Michigan right now. You know what? I'm happy to have you guys here, and I'm happy that we could continue working together. This is a new audience here at the Advices Radio Network. I thought it might be a prudent idea just to introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about who you are and where you're coming from. You know, this is going to be a different show. I think that in the past when we've worked together, we've covered a lot of surface questions, and Scott, I feel like you've always wanted to dig deeper, and I feel like we've got an opportunity here with a brand new show to do this any way we want. And I mean, One Direction is that we could take things deeper if we want to. So I'm excited to see where we go with it, and I'm excited to kind of have a rebirth. So Scott, could you just start out, man? What you got a hell of a lot of credentials. I know that much.
Yeah, I sent you that little blurb from my website. I mean, at my core, I'm just a meathead who doesn't want to grow up and figured out a way to do that.
Nice.
Basically, I mean, I just, I grew up reading Muscle and Fitness and Flex magazine, and I even kept those things. I had boxes of them that I cleared out of my parents' attic years ago now that I thought would be, absolutely vital material to hold on to for the future,
Nice.
Begin to start my library. And just a passion of mine from a very young age. I actually, when I did sports, this is kind of your typical story. When I was an athlete in high school, I wasn't a tremendous athlete at all, but I really liked the training as much as, like, the weight training especially, as much as, the other training. So just kept doing that through high school or through college, and then decided to go to graduate school to kind of, fulfill my passion. And from there, I've done a few things. I figured if I wanted to teach and dive into the information, the exercise physiology and quote-unquote bodybuilding science at a higher level, I'd need to get a PhD, which I just absolutely loved doing. It was just, kind of a one-dimensional life for the most part during those years. And along the way, I've become a licensed acupuncturist. It was a way to, initially it was just sort of a way to be able to do nutrition prescription wherever I might be, as long as I can see people in person. Most states, technically or legally, prescribing diets is not something, it's a no-no, even though it happens all over the place. That's usually falls under the scope of practice for registered dietitians and MDs and DCs and DOs, et cetera. So I've owned a gym and I started coaching people, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago or so, just sort of, online, because people would say, hey, I got some questions for you. Just started helping people. And I've been a personal trainer for years before that. I think I got certified in the early 90s. This is like probably some of our listeners were just being born and I was getting my ACSM certifications and that kind of thing. So I've just stayed in the game. I was a college professor for a while. Left that to become an acupuncturist, lived in Arizona for a good bit. A lot of people know that I trained with Dave Henry and worked with Dave Henry, so that's kind of a big asterisk. And then now I live in... Say it again?
I was going to say, that's where I first saw you, was on Dave Henry's videos just several years ago. I saw you kicking ass in your own gym with him.
Yeah, that was the gym, man. I still miss those days, you know. It's just so cool to have my own spot. So, and Dave, I still work with Dave. Dave, you know, assuming the Arnold invite goes through, we'll be cranking it down for another run at an Arnold Championship.
Nice.
And and then over the, I guess it was about almost, it was over 2 years ago now. I put out my ebook Fortitude Training, which basically was all the things I'd kind of come up with on a, you know, in the trenches type of experience in the gym, training and making lots of mistakes and learning from them, as well as the science that I was interweaving, over the years too.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was based on what I was doing with dog crap training, Dante Trudell's invention. And then I kind of outlined this all in the book. I actually tried out a even higher frequency program called Titan Training and learned some diabolical lessons there, literally overtrained myself, but figured out some things and combined those into a novel training system, Fortitude Training. And that's kind of been where I've, where my business has been focused on kind of spreading the word there. And I've been really happy because people love the training and it works as well.
It really seems to be catching on too.
Yeah. Usually, you know, you put an ebook out like that. This is what everyone told me. It's like, you got just a couple, 3 months and then that'll be it. You know, it's a flash in the pan type of deal. And maybe probably because I'm a horrible marketer.
Yeah.
But the book is good. I think I've sold more ebooks this year than I did the first year.
Wow.
Which is awesome. Yeah, which is great. So it's not slowing down, which I'm happy about. So that's a good thing. And I've written for Elite FTS. There's a bunch of articles there. This is just so people can follow up on those. And then I've written a few things for John Meadows' site too.
Nice.
So, and co-wrote, I was the guy who kind of gave the scientific support for John's book, The Brutality of Mountain Dog Training.
Yeah,
which outlines how he approaches training. So, John and I work together on that.
That's really cool. That's a lot of really exciting stuff. That's kind of it really surrounding what's happening right now. For anybody with their finger on the pulse of bodybuilding, I don't even think they needed to hear this introduction. They knew who you were.
Yeah. There's more coming too. I can't talk about it, but there's more coming soon.
Nice,
cool stuff. Yeah.
And where can people reach out to you? It's fortitudetraining.net, correct?
Yeah, you can just Google Fortitude Training and it pops right up.
All right,
cool. So, yeah.
And also here we have Jordan Peters. Jordan, I think that you weigh like, I'm going to say close to 100 pounds more than me. Well, maybe not. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but you probably would look at least 100 pounds more than me standing next to me, I'm guessing. How much are you weighing right now, man?
I'm like 275 right now, so I'm not really... the heaviest I've been.
Okay, well, 50. You got 50 pounds on me then. And tell us more about yourself. I think that, you know, I think everybody knows who you are too, but tell us about your credentials. Tell us about, you know, what you're working on now and where you came from.
Sure. I've always had a very sporty background. I went to very, very good rugby school. And from there, I went to Loughborough University to do my undergraduate in sports science. I didn't really care too much for the science then. It was mostly just I had decent grades from school, and that was probably the only thing that I wanted to do at that time. So I pursued that kind of without really overthinking it.
Yeah.
Posted through my undergrad. I didn't work hard at Loughborough, which was a shame actually, because Loughborough is a phenomenal university with some amazing professors, and I wish that I could redo that undergrad, because man, with my passion for learning now, it would be pretty cool. But hey, after that, whilst I was at Loughborough, in my whilst I was 18 or 19, I did my first bodybuilding competition, and I loved it, and I won my first show, and I went on to do nationals with the UKBFF, which is still the biggest and the hardest federation in the UK, as a junior, and I came third in my first year. So I had a really great introduction to bodybuilding. Despite still competing at the time, I still didn't really like start to work or study hard at Loughborough. Like I said, it was a shame. After leaving Loughborough, I then continued to learn a little bit more. I actually then started to work with Dr. Scott in 2012. Was the first time we hooked up together, because at that point I'd done my CISSN in sports nutrition, which on paper is a postgrad. I wouldn't consider it a postgrad, but it is. Not a real postgrad anyway, especially not the kind of postgrad that Scott tells me about. Where some of the stories he's told me about the learning that he's done has just been insane. But yeah, we started working together in 2012, and that really opened my mind to a lot of things. And then I started to become fascinated with learning, probably be the best way to describe it. And I was really fortunate, Ali, and I write this everywhere I can, that everything I really know, I can say Scott has taught me. And he knows that I'm forever grateful.
I'm blushing. Literally.
But thanks, I write everywhere I can, because it's the truth. Someone asked me the other day on a forum, literally just 2-3 days ago, like, how did I learn? How have I learned so much? And like, I'm now doing my full master's in physiology, and I can still say that Scott teaches me more.
Wow.
In honesty, which is a compliment to him, and it just shows how good a teacher he is. And I've been blessed to call him a friend over the last few years, because it's really really allowed me to grow with knowledge and as a person, and yeah. So in that sense, we share a lot of the same views and values, because I just don't think he's wrong on very many things.
Easy to be his friend then, right, Scott?
Exactly. I pay him a lot to say this shit, so he's doing good so far. He's earning his money.
I think when things are evidence-based, you can kind of understand it a lot more and rationalize it in your brain. And I like that approach. I like an evidence-based approach. I hate the idea of just saying, just do this, without even understanding the whys behind it. And I think it's really important that we understand why we're doing something, which is why, obviously, this is something that I'm so happy to be a part of, because it allows us to share what we kind of know and the whys behind things. And if we can give back some information and pass on information, I think that's a very nice thing and a good thing to do. From a competitive point of view, I'm an okay bodybuilder. I'm starting to get a little bit better. Hopefully next year I'll improve a little bit more again, and I'll see what I can do at those shows. But so far my personal bodybuilding has been okay. We'll leave it at that.
He's a pro, so he's decent.
Nice. You have a training site of your own, right? You and your partner, Corin?
Yes, we do. So we own Train by JP. That was a cool name when we first came up with it, but now it kind of frustrates me a little bit, because Corin is the absolute driving force of half the shit we've done. In fact, probably 70% of the shit that we get done. she's a machine when it comes to working. So we're kind of stuck with that name. I think everyone's well aware how just incredible Corin is, really, on every level. So we have a member site that I'm fairly certain is just going to go over 1,000 in the next couple of days.
Hell yeah.
Which is really cool. I'm going to add them all up on the 22nd, which is our end of renewal date. And I'm 99% sure from looking at the numbers, I haven't been counting them as I go, but I've been keeping a loose eye on them. I'm fairly certain we're going to crack 1,000 this month, which was a goal, obviously, from the outset, and it's taken us 2 years to do it. So that would be a great thing. So over there on that site, we offer training, nutrition videos, lots of stuff on drugs, which is helpful because us being from the UK, the drug laws afford us that ability to talk openly about what we do.
Yeah.
Obviously, at no stage am I telling anyone to do this or do that. That's absolutely at the viewer's discretion, how they implement the information that they're watching. Obviously, they're listening to my experience with these drugs, and I'm just openly sharing that. And I'm openly sharing some ideas of if I could go back again and redo some things, how I would maybe a little bit more cautious, or how I would be a little bit more sensible.
Use more insulin.
We're giving out that kind of information. So if that's something that you think could be useful for you, then check out the site, and obviously we can help you there.
Nice. Yeah, high video quality too, and you guys are constantly putting new stuff out.
Sure. We invest in good videographers. Because first and foremost, it's a video site. So we have over 50 hours of content. So we use Rebecca Andrews and Gus Napier, who are two of the best kind of bodybuilding videographers in the UK.
Nice.
So we invest a lot of that money that we make from the site back into the site. And we'll continue to do that. As much as we can, really. And if people keep liking what we're doing, we'll keep trying to invest more and more to give people what they want.
Nice. Yeah, I know a lot of the people. I posted up a link, and for anybody who's interested, if you guys are over at the Advices Radio forums, you can go to the training section, and there's a link to both Scott's site and Jordan's site there. And when I posted it up, everybody was saying, like, oh, I'm already a member over there, and oh yeah, I downloaded the Fortitude training program. And so it's cool to see, you know, all the support that you guys are getting, and for good reason too, because there's so much information out there on the internet now. I could go to YouTube and I could find 100 different people telling me, you know, the way I'm supposed to, quote unquote, you know, use a supplement, or, you know, how I need to do something. But half the people, man, if you look at them and you look at their level of experience, I can't understand why they're getting followers.
I think a part of that, and just to segue right into discussing things, is that people want, and this is human nature, this isn't really a criticism, but you want a simple answer. It's nice to see things in black and white terms. So when someone offers that as opposed to an it depends, or let's take a look at the variables that could make, you know, this way of training or this way of eating potentially work for you and not for work for you, that requires some more mental effort, which is what some people love. That's what Jordan loves. That's what I love. That's what you love, Scott.
Yeah.
I love the mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
You know, and I've certainly, you know, I've got the overanalyzer gene built into me to a certain degree, but I like to get to the bottom of things and understand the underpinnings of how things are working. But some people just like, you know, you bring your car into the mechanics, like, they just, like, just fix it. I just want the car to drive faster.
Yeah, yeah.
Or just want the body to be bigger. I don't want you to tell me about camshafts and, you know, oil viscosity or whatever other things. That's not interesting to me. And unfortunately, it's relevant, though, in terms of, and everyone, I mean, probably most people listening have had bad mechanics and good mechanics. And it's actually, now that I think about it, it's probably a good analogy in that, you know, body mechanics are essentially what, quote unquote, body mechanics are what personal trainers are, online coaches are. And if they know what they're doing, they can do a great job. But if you're just coming to them because they've got the cheapest service, and you can get ripped off, just like you can with auto mechanics.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jordan had just said something. He said that he has a passion for sharing this information. And Scott, in the past, on a message conversation, you had said to me, or maybe it was on the phone, that you feel like your calling is to help educate people. And I want everybody to understand that that's what our passion is, and that's the reason that we're doing this show. This is what we're here to do, and this is what we want to continue doing. So I'm really grateful that we can continue doing that, guys. And I'm ready to dive in if you are.
Yeah. And I have one comment on there. Interestingly enough, I just heard this from a guy by the name of Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian, not Jordan Peterson, but Jordan Peterson. He's a professor, fully tenured professor at University of Toronto. And he's come to recognize, and I won't talk about getting into what he's embroiled with. It's kind of hit the net pretty hard. But he's realized that the internet is a modern day university. This is the university that where you can, if you're so inclined, go and generate an amazing education for yourself.
Sure.
YouTube videos, what have you. I mean, the fact that you can get so many followers and so many listeners on podcasts and videos makes what we're doing with these podcasts as powerful as universities, because the information is no longer exclusive to the hallowed grounds of the university campus.
That's
so
a great point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I heard him say that, I agreed with a lot of things he was saying in these podcasts. I'm like, whoa, yep, that's exactly how I kind of felt about it. I didn't feel so, you know, sometimes I have regret that I left formal academia. And he was basically saying, you know, this is sort of the academia of the future. So I like that notion, of course.
All right. So to start up, we've got a bunch of questions lined up here. If anybody wants to submit questions for the next episode, you can go to advicesradio.com and you'll see a section there for the forum. And at that point, you just go to the bodybuilding section, and we have a thread for the Muscle Minds Q&A. I'll keep it simple here, guys, and I'll just start from the top and start working my way down. First question is there any reason you guys would ever help your client design an oral only or pro-hormone cycle? Or would you insist on adding testosterone as a base? I'll turn to you with this one first, Jordan. And the reason that he's asking is he says he finds that pro-hormones in orals are very popular where he lives in the Czech Republic. And he thinks a lot of it has to do with being young guys that are, quote, too scared to pin themselves.
That's pretty common now across all areas. I don't see that being just specific to where he's from. I mean, when I've been to some of those Central European countries, the ease of access to testosterone, pharmaceutical red testosterone, is very, very high. It's really, really good quality stuff that you can get easily. I mean, Serbia is just across the road from Czech Republic, and you can walk into the pharmacy there and buy Galenica Test D without a prescription. When I went to Serbia to see Milo Sasev, I brought back like 200 shots of Test D in my bag.
Oh, man.
That was legal to do as well, because you can legally bring back in an amount into the UK for personal use too. So I bought it legally, and then I bought it back in legally. It was fucking brilliant. I would have definitely had it well, clearly, but thankfully it was just nice then not to have to break the law. So they've got ease of access to stuff there. So there's no excuse that they can just easily get pro hormones. I personally wouldn't. I think if you're using anything exogenous, that testosterone is king in this situation. There are lots and lots of pro hormones that I'll admit as well. I have no idea what they are or what they do. So I'm not the best person to give advice on those. There's lots of information on anabolics, and we know to a certain extent that the benefits and the dangers. Whereas, although prohormones are just structurally altered steroids, I still have no idea what the implications of that are, what that would potentially be. From clearly a liver toxicity standpoint, for a first ever cycle, you could avoid that quite easily by just taking 300 milligrams per week of testosterone. Impact on cholesterol, usually those type of drugs, the prohormone drugs, have an even greater negative effect on cardiovascular health than testosterone does at 250 to 300 milligrams per week. So from an overall kind of bigger picture, they're not ideal drugs to be using, in my opinion. The only time I would suggest an oral only is for females. That would be the only time. And in that case, it still wouldn't be a prohormone, it would be Anavar. So that would be my advice and my opinion there.
Okay, right on. How about yourself, Scott? Do you have any input on this one?
As we just were sort of foreshadowing, I'm pretty much on the same page with that. There's just generally a couple things. Generally speaking, there's a reason why designer steroids and prohormones didn't make it as prescription steroids. Why they're not, where they haven't been historically as widely available. And some of that, in many cases, either they weren't as effective or they were hepatotoxic beyond, you know, what is reasonable. Usually they test this, of course, in animals or what have you. So that's telling you something right there. I think the context of this is a coach talking to a client, and I think once that client, you know, in the Czech Republic or wherever he or she may be, realizes that, you know, the hepatotoxicity is an issue, and that, you know, an injection is not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Then you've kind of resolved that issue. If you sort of give in, which I think, you know, some coaches, there's a lot, you've heard the horror stories as well as I have, coaches just sort of just literally abusing their clients with crazy drug protocols. And this would sort of fall into that category. We know, like, stuff like Superdrol, for instance, can be used. Jordan's talked about it before on podcast, you know, but how there's actually, I think, two or three, maybe even four published case studies of individuals who were taking Superdrol at, you know, a dose that is not uncommon, who had some pretty incredible liver issues just after a matter of weeks or months. So some of these things can be really, really hepatotoxic. Your appetite is shot. Of course, your lipid profile goes all to hell. You feel terrible. And compared to what testosterone would do, for instance, oh my gosh, it's a world's way.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, with women, as Jordan noted, is that they don't need as much to create favorable gains. So, you know, I can't say that I know specifically that women and men's livers are identical in this regard, in the ability to detoxify androgens. But, you know, the relative of dose that a guy would take versus what a woman would take in the case of something like Anavar it's not even really comparable. So, you know, a small dose in a woman wouldn't do almost anything for a guy in many cases. At least not a high-level competitor. So, yeah, I think that's just, like, it's kind of a silly way to go about it, especially when things are available. I think there are people who've made some gains because prohormones really aren't legal anymore in the U.S. The talk about those have gone down. But I have the sense that a lot of the guys would make gains, a lot of times hold a massive amount of water, depending on what they took. And then when they try to cycle off, and some of this has to do with the mindset as well, you know, they do what a lot of guys would do. They're not on something, so they stop training and their diet goes to shit. you basically just hop on this sort of bodybuilder's yo-yo,
yeah,
where you gain a bunch of water and you gain some strength, and then, you know, when you finally feel so crappy, you have to stop. You stop going into the gym, and you lose whatever you might have gained. So it doesn't set people up very well for a long life in bodybuilding, as far as what I've seen.
That makes sense. Next question is kind of an interesting one here. This is getting away from the science and talking more about the mindset. And I'll start with you, Scott. I'm going to let you answer this one however you want. You don't have to necessarily cover all these questions, but you'll get the point he's getting at here. He says, and he's got four of them. I'm going to read them all. What is the shittiest client you've ever had? What made them the shittiest client you've ever had? What do you think the red flags are that indicate a shit client? Or I think he's from the UK, so he might say shite. Is that right, Jordan?
Shite. it's pretty used as well, but shitty too.
Okay. And last but not least, why do you think people pay someone to rate them a diet but then cheat on the plan?
I might answer that first one. I think I might have mentioned this client to Jordan before.
Okay.
So this was a long time ago. This would never happen to me. This was, maybe a decade ago. And a guy came to me who's pretty well known, really good competitor. I'm not going to say even what his placings were, but he placed in the top five, the junior nationals one year. And he came to me, had like 8 weeks before the junior nationals to do the USAs. So he was kind of a front runner. And this is maybe even back in the days when they only gave like two pro cards at the USAs, but still, you know, really good bodybuilder. And he came to me and, he had his own super supplement regimen that he was on, you know, that was totally his to manage and deal with and do. That's, you know, his thing. People just ask me questions and I try to provide education, but I never tell anyone what to do specifically. So he sent me a couple weeks worth of photos to follow his progress. And then his camera broke.
Uh-oh.
or he couldn't get the camera to work. And he couldn't find a camera for a couple weeks.
Wait. And then his girlfriend wasn't home to take pictures.
Yes, his girlfriend couldn't take the picture. There's nothing to set the camera up on, you know, to do that. And this went on, like, and he's a better competitor than I am, and he's been around for a while. And he's like, man, but I'm coming in good. And I believe he was also sending me skin folds, which I don't think were real. I had no pictures. So we went a month, more than a month before the USAs with nothing. Like, just, you know, one thing, all three of his grandmothers died, and, you know, the whole kid and caboodle. It was just crazy. So I go up to Vegas to the USAs, and I'm just going to, you know, see friends and go to the show and then help him as well. And I find him, he just gotten some color put on, and we sneak down from the hotel room because there's no good lighting. We went out back behind the hotel, and I said, let's take a look at you and see how you're doing. And he had done a peak week protocol that, you know, the same one that I still use with people, some variation, what I was doing at that point. And he dropped his sweats, and I was flabbergasted.
Uh-oh.
I was like, what? I mean, he looked atrocious. He looked really, really bad. It's nothing like how he looked previous to that. And what had happened, he had basically decided to just completely remove the super supplements from his regimen. And he was doing massive amounts of cardio that he wasn't telling me about. This all came out. He eventually admitted it after the show. Just didn't do anything. But here's the kicker. During the course of that prep, he started asking me questions. So he was like, you know, what do you think about if someone were to do this and this and this? And I'm like, well, this might happen. You have to adjust. It's like, oh, okay, that's cool. And if you did that, what would you do then? And I'm like, well, you'd do this and this. He asked me literally dozens, maybe even 100 questions of somewhat depth over the course of that time.
Yeah.
Just these questions that weren't specifically related to what he was doing, but they were interesting for me to entertain, and I, you know, enjoyed the interaction. He was not doing anything related to, he was just asking me questions, I presume, because he was using me to help train his clients.
Oh, that's what I thought you were going to say.
Yes. No. He's just asking me questions. He had like a 2 month long Q&A with me on a weekly basis, and he looked awful at the show. He looked terrible. I don't know, even know why he would do that to himself. He like literally, he got up on stage and it was like he just wanted to curl up and run away.
Oh, man.
So it was really bizarre. It was real. I don't know why he would do that. You know, he got some, you know, quote unquote free information out of me, but he was lying to me too. You know, through it right through his teeth the entire time for basically 2 months. But he still got on stage. He did it. You know, so that was probably the quote unquote shittiest client I've ever had. And so I'll let Jordan answer the other questions about red flags and why people might pay someone and then cheat on the diet.
That was a good story.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'll never forget that. It was so bizarre.
I think with the hiring someone to then not follow the diet, I think this is just human nature, that they're hoping that if they invest money, which to some people is really easy to do, if you're fairly well off, then money's nothing. You'll just lay down cash and then think, well, I paid for it, so I may stick to it.
Yeah.
And the likelihood comes around when they actually have no ability to adhere, that they then think, well, it's only money, I don't really care. And then they don't stick to the plan. For those that really value money because they don't have very much of it, then they're more inclined to follow what you're saying because they would rather be spending their money on other things. In terms of red flags, what was the part of the question for that?
Yeah, they said, what are the red flags that indicate that somebody's going to be a bad client?
A big one for me would be when they've told me that they've not had success with another coach that I really like.
Mm.
Mm. So I've had a client that came to me from Shelby saying that he really didn't get on with Shelby. And that straight away I was like, it's very strange because Shelby's awesome. And then within a month, he then asked for the next 2 months he still had left be refunded as well.
You get a little muffled there sometimes. I don't know if the phone's not by your mouth sometimes.
He's eating.
Oh, okay.
is that better?
Yeah, that's great.
Sure. So, I mean, this guy left Shelby and then, yeah, within a month decided that I was no good for him either.
Hmm.
So then if he's going to go on to the next coach and he didn't get on with me and he didn't get on with Shelby, I don't think he's going to do very well with the next one too. So prior coaching is always a bit of a sign to me. And then, yeah, that would be the biggest red flag for me, I'd say.
Okay. Speaking of Shelby, he actually has a last minute submission. If you guys would like if you guys would like to entertain his question.
I prompted that. Yeah. Cause he was making a funny comment. Do we want to do it now?
That's good by me. Can you handle a Shelby question, Jordan?
For sure, always.
All right. He says, and he says this is specifically to Jordan. How often do you change your training split and training style/modality? What do you base your changes on? And he adds, Scott can answer it too, but I think he's kind of married to the fortitude stuff right now, but not sure.
Okay, that's a really good question. I try to run with things until I pretty much kill them off to make any more progress. So I stick with things for a really long time. I don't chop and change easily. So over the last 5 years, I've maybe trained with only two or three different approaches, really. And the main change for those is just the frequency at which I'm hitting body parts.
Hmm.
And then when the frequency changes, the volume changes. So it's not really all that much of a change in my mind. So for the last 18 months, I've been running Fortitude, which I absolutely loved. And then I noticed with the new demands placed on me with school, while still trying to keep up with work, and I was obviously managing Corinne's prep at the time, which is very hard to do because it kind of then still feels like my own prep too.
Yeah.
My recovery capabilities were just shocking at 3 times a week. I just made the progress that I was in the summer when I was really chilled and I didn't have any of these looming deadlines for school. So I went, about 9 weeks ago now, I went back to just twice a week work, increased my volume a little bit, and that seemed to just allow me to recover a little bit better. And then I'm going to run this until I've exhausted this, and then I'll go back to Fortitude again. And I'll just go back to 3 times a week frequency where I reduce the volume a little more. And then that kind of novel stimulus after a break from it, in my mind, will kickstart some further growth again.
Okay, interesting.
It's only ever really just that slight adjustment in frequency and volume. I'm not ever going to go full bore, high volume training. I hate it, to be honest. I just can't see how I'd ever make progress doing that. I can't see how people make progress doing that in general, but for me personally, like, I'll get halfway through the session and I feel like I'm now just kicking the crap out of a muscle, and just for no benefit. So I'll always stick to the lower end of volume.
Right on. And it sounds like you've been doing this for a long time. You know what works for you.
Sure, I think so. I know how much volume I can handle at a given training frequency. I know what exercise selection as well to pick for what works for me. And that's what it comes down to, really, just working a volume that's just most appropriate for you. And that generally will come down to intensity, how hard you can attack these work sets.
Yeah.
If you can really, really, really go at something very, very hard and set all-time PBs with perfect form, you don't need very many sets to do that, especially with your exercise selection leaning towards the hardest, most demanding movements.
Right on. Do you have any thoughts on this one, Scott?
Yeah, what Jordan just said there is what I was thinking when he first started talking, is that if, that's a big if for some people, to literally go in the gym. And anyone listening to this can probably attest to this, unless you train at an awesome gym where people just go for broke all the time. But most gyms, you just don't see people who... you look at them and say, this guy's trying to kill himself.
Yeah.
Like his wife he just caught his wife cheating on him the night before, and he's just filled with rage or what have you. You don't see that kind of effort level. And that's, you know, once you have that in place, then your ability to recover from a certain amount of volume is just limited.
Yeah.
And obviously people can train with high volume and do well. There's just far too many examples of that. The thing that I've just sort of noticed in general, and I think this is something I don't want to speak for him, I think this is something that Dante, for instance, noticed a long time ago that led to DC training, which is a high frequency, all out, go for broke style of training.
Yeah.
Is that the guys who can get away with doing high volume are usually the guys who have tremendous genetic gifts in the first place.
Hmm.
I even heard a buddy of mine, John. This is the one you sent me. A buddy here in town sent me a kind of obscure recording made with Mike Mentzer.
Yeah.
From years ago. Yeah, I can send it to you, Scott. He did a radio show literally with someone in Australia, and he was talking about Arnold. And of course, Arnold was, you know, sort of the king of volume training, and Mentzer was the complete opposite of that. And Mentzer, you know, he said this is just because Arnold had such phenomenal genetics.
Yeah.
That's why he was able to create the body that he did. But you see that when the guys who, I mean, there's really no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If you become unbelievably strong by training incredibly hard, eating appropriately, to where, you know, you're pressing 405 on incline or flat presses. If you do those, you're squatting 5, you're deadlifting 5 or 6 for reps. You're going to have an impressive physique. There are some people who won't, a very small minority. They're just freaky strong without the size. In a lot of those cases, in the case of powerlifters, they've maybe even intentionally kept their weight down because of weight limits. But if you couple the eating with the intention to gain muscle mass and the progressive overload with the intention of becoming the strongest guy in your gym, you basically are almost creating a situation where there's no choice. You're going to have to be a big dude. You may not have Phil Heath genetics for symmetry and balance, but you're going to be a monster. That's the big if, is if someone is willing to go into the gym or if they enjoy it. I just like training that way because the screws that are loose in my head tell me to do that. So if you like training that way, then you can do it, you know, but you have to just meter your volume or meter the stress in some way, shape, or form. In my opinion.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah. But as far as my training, the thing is, I am, Shelby's right. I think we've even talked about this. I'm kind of married to fortitude training, but I'm playing around with variations that will come out in future versions of the training system. So that's kind of where I switch things up, is I look for ways to modify things. And I've got a couple, Jordan's privy to these as well. I think he's used two of the main things that I come up with in his own training.
Interesting.
He's been my lab rat willingly to do some of these things. And, of course, my training system, too, I'm realizing this idea of volume, I've got 3 volume tiers in there, knowing that recovery ability is fairly dramatic, fairly variable. There's someone who posted on my board earlier this week that he's having a hard time recovering just from volume tier 1, which isn't much at all. It's sort of the lowest. I mean, he's getting just annihilated. And I'm like, my first thing was like, that's awesome. You're training like an animal.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's got something else going on, you know, medically, what have you, or he stays up late. I didn't get all the details in that particular thread about the rest of his lifestyle. But if you're only able to recover from the lowest volume tier, in my system, that's great. That means you're going for it. That makes me happy. Because you've captured the essential ingredient, the extent of effort, quote-unquote intensity in the bodybuilding lay terms, that I think is the main thing about training, that resistance training, that makes such a good stimulus for muscle growth.
That makes sense. I know that, Shelby had tried to start training each body part more often, and he found, though, that he was having a difficult time recovering. Usually he trains each body part about once a week. What you're saying makes total sense, because when you talk about somebody who trains like very intensely, and it's something that I think it's hard to explain to somebody what intensity is, but it's something that you can always continue to develop. And I feel like his level of intensity development is far beyond what a lot of people can comprehend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a natural, it's a reflexive urge to pull away from painful experiences, regardless of what kind of pain it is, physical pain, emotional pain. You know, we want to protect ourselves from those things.
Yeah.
So you have to develop. I mean, one way I look at it sometimes is the more pain and discomfort you feel, the better it is. That's what you want. You're wanting this, and this, of course, can be overdone, and I've done it hundreds of times, thousands if you consider individual workouts, probably. But you're seeking out, at least during, you know, the moment of training, to brutalize yourself, because that's what will foster improvement. And at the same time, this is where it's so difficult, at least for people who can capture that mindset. You also have to realize that the rest of your day should be about recovery and limiting stress. So you can't burn the candle on both ends in the gym and at the other end during the rest of your day and expect that you're gonna send a clear and consistent signal you know, to your body that muscle growth is an appropriate adaptation. So yeah, you have to be an animal. Like a buddy of mine from a long time ago, we did our doctoral degrees in the same lab. He used to call it dog training. This is before dog crap even came out. This is like 10 years before DC training.
Okay.
And he said, you train like an animal, eat like a dog, and sleep like a dog. Most dogs, you give them whatever food, they'll eat whatever's in front of them, and they nap a lot. All three of mine are napping. They're lying around me right now. And when you're in the gym, you train like an animal. And, like, simple as that. That's kind of what it comes down to. If you can do that, then you've got a good start, in my opinion.
I like that. Next question is about red blood count and hemoglobin. He says, will doing more cardio lower red blood count and hemoglobin? I'm prescribed HRT at 200 milligrams of test sip a week and nothing else. I got a script to donate blood once a month, but my red blood count always climbs up so much that I have to go off of everything for about 3 months to get things back on track. Besides donating blood, what are some ways to lower hemoglobin? At what point would you say that's too high and to get off TRT? Cannot seem to get a good answer. He also adds, I just got my blood work back and my red blood count and hemo are staying the same, but I virtually have no iron levels. This is a side note.
Mm-hmm. I got it.
Okay.
I wonder if he's talking about ferritin or iron.
On the iron question?
Yeah, and so ferritin's most important here. That's a better indicator of your iron status. So that would, you know, God, if you could have posted the blood work, that would be a good thing. Hmm. So he asked about doing cardio, and yes, cardio can cause hemodilution. At least when people get really fit, you see this in aerobic endurance athletes. And that's just because oxygen delivery, the more blood volume you have, the better oxygen delivery you can get, which is something that's limited by your heart. So that's just a kind of a hemodynamic or cardiodynamic function, an adaptation to doing lots of cardio. I don't know if I would count on that, because you end up doing so much cardio that you're gonna interfere with your gains in the gym. So thoughts are, check with your doctor on all this. Is it possible to change the amount of phlebotomy, the volume of phlebotomy that he's having done, to sort of titrate it to get himself in a good spot? He asked about what's appropriate hematocrit. Usually 55% is kind of the top end of the range. A lot of docs like to have you below 50, so that's up to his doctor to kind of decide. It sounds like, you know, he's got, these are all questions really for his doctor. Okay. It'd be interesting to know what his red blood cell distribution width is. RDW is usually how that's the acronym. That's the, abbreviation on the blood work. And that tells you basically the size of the blood cells, tells you about how mature they are, and whether he's, you know, what's going on in terms of the maturation of the blood cells that may be causing this. So that's something his doctor could look at and interpret for him. It sounds like he's okay right now, but he feels like crap. One thing that, you know, one way to balance this is to make sure he's staying properly hydrated. That will decrease your hematocrit, at least transiently. So if you're continually drinking lots of water, that would be one way that he could decrease the hematocrit and maybe with less phlebotomy have a better iron status at the same time. So there's a lot of things to juggle here. And without the blood work, it's even harder to do. Okay. The other question he might want to ask, the whole idea with, or one of the main important things with having a high hematocrit is that it increases your risk for clots. So he might want to double check and just see what his PTT is, his clotting time.
Okay.
I think it's partial thromboplastin time, I think is what that stands for. That tells you just about the clotting factors involved, and just see where he stands there. That's just a general risk thing. And check with his doctor too. I mean, people like to use phytate or inositol 6-phosphate. It's called phytate or phytic acid. Is a chelating agent, and some people, like there's studies in rats where you can reduce iron absorption that way, but that's not what he wants to do with his iron levels being so low, but that's another balancing point. So those are just some things that he can consider and look into and just bring to his doc, in my opinion.
Okay.
Because it sounds like he's, without knowing whether he needs iron or ferritin, it's hard to know exactly what's going on, but it sounds like he's, you know, another thing possibly too, I'm trying to think if I've, this just occurred to me, I'm trying to think if I've seen anyone address this in this way, but he might consider, he could talk with Dr. Chrysler, who I know is in favor of this because the YouTube videos are out there, and maybe get a referral to him from his current doc and consider the idea of doing subcutaneous shots with smaller amounts. That tends to keep estrogen under control better. So that might be one way to meter in the testosterone in a way that doesn't cause a spike in erythropoiesis and elevate his red blood cells so quickly. So he could check on that too. If he's doing like, you know, 200 milligrams a week, you know, if you look at the blood levels, the pharmacokinetics, what happens with a shot like that, you get a pretty substantial spike in the first 24, 48 hours.
Sure.
And then, and then levels drop back down, you know, over the course of the week. So that spike may be what's promoting the red blood cell formation. Okay. So you can eliminate that and get a more natural, quote unquote, a more endogenous testosterone like release pattern with smaller doses spread out and used subcutaneously. But you got to use, you can't just use, I'm assuming he's getting prescription stuff, you know, which people get awful welts, and there's also the possibility that you're going to cause some lipodystrophy. You can kind of mess up the subcutaneous fat by doing those shots all in one spot. So that's all stuff that Chrysler or maybe even his doc could address. But the only reason I mentioned Chrysler is so many docs, you know, it's kind of like they're sort of static. Not that his doc isn't necessarily, but they're static in their learning curve. So if a client or a patient brings them something, like doing subcutaneous testosterone shots, they'll just immediately reject it without looking into it because they're so dang busy. And so they don't, you know, until that gets literally presented and becomes, you know, a standardized way of performing these injections. Yeah. A lot of docs would just blow it off. You know, it's like, okay, whatever. I'm not prescribing that for you. I don't know anything about it.
Well, I made a note here too for him to, if he wants to, he could upload his lab work to clear that up for us about the iron. I posted that over at the forum for him. And,
okay.
I think we covered this one fairly thoroughly, so I'll just move on to the next one here and turn it over to Jordan. This person is specifically asking about Metaform, which is a water-based SEO, but I suppose we could broaden that topic if you wanted to speak about SEO in general. His question is, Metaform seems to be a hot topic for the moment, and I'm curious what your best protocol would be. My goal is to utilize it long-term to increase size in my arms, shoulders, and calves. Would it be best to use it during a blast or on a cruise? Do you recommend any stretches or pump up in the muscle after injection?
So this stuff is interesting. I have three bottles of it sitting here.
I have one and a half sitting here.
Uh-oh. You got an underfilled one, apparently, huh?
Do you have half left because you've used half?
I had three to start.
Uh-huh.
You're going to better answer this better than me, then, because...
Yeah.
I only bought three bottles and I still only have three bottles because as soon as it turned up and was in this kind of thick liquid state, I had no urge to inject it into myself. So three bottles is as it stands until I decide that it's not going to make my muscles eat themselves.
Yeah.
If you have fuller lips next time I see you, Jordan will know what happened. All the wrinkles are gone from your face, and you look like Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. We'll know what went on with the Metaform.
I did this last time. One of my friends and I, who is a brilliant British bodybuilder, bought some SCR. I can't remember which one. It was one of the sponsors for Geared Up. But he used his SEO really, really, really well. Didn't greedy at all with the shot. You'd never be able to tell he was using it, and his arms looked amazing.
Nice.
But that said, he already had a lot of muscle. So these SEO shots just kind of added finishing touches. And because I know his physique quite well, to me it was apparent that it was like, oh, that's really cool. That looks awesome. That's just given your bicep an extra little peak and your triceps just hanging that little bit lower. But if he was just using it to just refine his arm.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea of overusing SEO, because I can spot it on someone from a mile off, and I think it looks shit. Mm. I hate that swollen, detailless, strange proportion to your bicep and non-existent forearm look.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I've used SEO in 2012, and I used Syntherol at the time. I initially followed the Synthetech description for it, starting with 1 mil in each head per day, and then after 10 days taking it up, and then after 10 days taking it up again. That to me was overkill, and creates that oversighted look.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us should be going for. Now, obviously, I haven't used this Metaform stuff yet, so I don't know the difference that it might have. If someone tries to tell me that this SEO doesn't blur detail, then I'm just a major skeptic. But maybe it doesn't. Scott, can you tell me if you think it blurs detail?
It's hard for me to say yet. I'll tell you that I started with it, what they say is that 1 cc to 1.5 cc's per week per head is a good place to go with biceps, and so that's where I started. And after I got through about half a bottle, I didn't see any change in size. I had done, let's see, it was 2 weeks. So I had done two, because they say you only need to do it once a week. But that's the directions from the site. When I started looking online and talking to other people, they were using much more. I moved up to 2.5 and eventually now 3 cc's per head per week. And now I'm moving it to 3 cc's every 5 days. I still haven't seen any actual growth on the measuring tape. I will say that my arms are always a lot fuller now. For me, biceps tend to go flat quickly. If I'm feeling small, you know, if I haven't eaten yet in the morning, my arms are usually always going to look really weak. Or if I'm dieting, the first thing to fade on me is going to be my biceps. So even if I'm not going to gain any size from it, I could see how it could be beneficial during a very hard diet. As far as the blurring goes, I don't know, because I'm off season right now and I'm not in the greatest shape. So it's really hard for me to tell how much it blurs detail. But I can tell you that it would take, in my opinion, substantially more than what it's claimed to. And that being said, it's very expensive. So you're looking at like $90 or more for a 20cc vial. You know, how does that compare to, you know, painless pumps, which is $120 for, you know, a 100cc bottle?
Sure. Yeah. I'm not bashing the product in any way. I don't have any feedback to give on it right now. But my feedback is always just going to be, I'll say it how I see it. I think there is some scope for smart SEO use. I think it can add some touches to fill in some gaps on some body parts. But that, for me, is all it's ever going to be. It's going to be filling in some gaps. Like I'll say I've successfully used Nolotil. Showday.
and that didn't seem to blur any detail, and got a fairly good swell in the site, and just kind of gave everything just that little bit of extra pop. But that seems to be really hard to come by again at the moment.
Yeah.
But if I could get that again, if anyone has any Nolotil that they want to send me, please. And I'll write you a diet plan or something. That Nolotil is really good.
Scott, do your biceps hurt? Are they in? Is there inflammation there and pain?
That's a good question. And I was going to add that I will say that first off, I am right there with you, Jordan, that when I looked at this, it's like a gel in the vial, and that kind of creeped me out. But I had talked to enough people that have used it and had some success with it that I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to take the risk. Drawing it up is very difficult. But then when you actually apply it to the muscle, it goes in very, very smooth and easy. It's not like trying to push dense oil in. And at 1 to 2 cc's, it's quite painless. When I've gotten up to 3, there's definitely, I could feel it in there, and it lasts for a few days, that sensation. The idea is that it's supposed to draw water in. This is hyaluronic acid, the same thing as Juvederm. And the idea is that it's supposed to draw water into it, and it holds, as they claim, 500 times its weight in water.
So I need to address that.
Yeah, okay. And also, though, before you say that, Scott, I want to mention that.
Sure.
I wonder, Jordan, if that answers your question about would it blur the muscle. I don't know, but we are drawing water in.
Like, Scott and I had a discussion about this already. I sent him a print screen of the ingredients and then the potential claims of the ingredients. And then Scott, being the all-knowing man that he is, got a pretty good insight on that compound that you just mentioned, Scott, because I had no idea. So I'd actually never heard of it.
Okay.
That's my usual go-to. When I haven't heard of something, I message Dr. Scott.
What is this? You're not the only one. I get lots of messages, man. All the time. It's interesting. I'm looking at that website now, the metaform.com website. And so let's say you take just a mil, about a gram's worth.
Okay.
Of this stuff. And let's say that it does absorb 5,000 times its weight or its mass in fluid. So that 1 milliliter would become 5,000 milliliters. That's 5 liters. That's over a gallon. That's well over, it's close to a gallon and a half.
that presuming it's 100% active ingredient.
Well, you know, it says this polymer, the novel of, it's not even, I mean, this may have been written by someone who isn't a native English speaker. The novel of Metaform SCO is its actions as a polymer. This polymer has the ability to absorb 5,000 times its weight in fluid and is self-dispersing, meaning it will fill the entire muscle head on its own, the whole head, the whole thing. Moving freely through the membrane. So, I don't know where the 5,000, I mean, of course, there's no citations here to see what they mean by this, but let's just say it's 50 times.
Okay.
You know, so 50 is about 28 grams in an ounce. So, you know, if you put basically you get about one, if you put 2 mils in there, or put 3 grams in there, that's going to be 150 grams worth of fluid, you know, that it pulls to itself, which is like 5 ounces. So that's like a half a cup, a little more than a half a cup of fluid. That would just blow up your muscle like crazy. That would send you to the hospital. I mean, imagine so I don't know what we can make of that sort of claim, what that means, because they don't provide any substantiation for it. It sounds cool, though. It's like, wow, this is powerful stuff.
Yeah.
And then moving freely through the membrane, I don't know what membrane they mean. The cell membrane? are they, you know, there's membranes can have different meanings, but like the membrane doesn't really mean anything to me. I don't know what's meant by that. So, and the other thing it's meant, I think is Metaform the same as Juvederm? Is it the same thing?
I believe it's the same active ingredient.
Yeah. It says this effect is utilized as hyaluronic, is also known in the medical community as Juvederm. Okay. So hyaluronic acid is, it's a glycosaminoglycan, I think. There's proteoglycans and aminoglycans and basically combinations of carbohydrate and protein or amino acids that form the base or ground substance of cartilage. It's found in connective tissue. So hyaluronic acid is great stuff, for instance, for cartilage, interarticular cartilage in joints. And they use, you know, in medicine, they'll inject hyaluronic acid into like a knee joint. Okay. And it has anti-inflammatory properties and helps with healing. So that's where this little blurb here says, a disaccharide polymer that exists within our bodies, hyaluronic acid acting as a lubricant, aids in the healing process, scar tissue mitigation, cellular migration, overall anti-inflammatory actions, and skin repair. So that's, you know, that fits with the hyaluronic acid. You know, lasting up, like there's just kind of a hodgepodge. I'm not going to go through each of them, but there's kind of a hodgepodge of factoids related to hyaluronic acid here. And, you know, this absorbing 5,000 times its weight in fluid. Like, that's crazy. It's like a black hole for fluid, man. So this doesn't in any way say that it can't work for people, because obviously it has.
Yeah.
But when you just like make these, when you have this sort of outrageous pseudoscientific claims kind of all thrown together, that just creates a little bit of doubt in my mind as to what's going on here. Just sort of my spidey sense gets kicked on a little bit when I see that sort of thing. So yeah. It makes me wonder. I mean, I don't know how different this is from the Juvederm product itself. Could probably figure that out with enough digging. But the one thing that's interesting is that's meant, the whole idea, I think, is this stuff stays in the muscle.
Yes.
It stays there for a prolonged period of time. And it'll apparently it does that, at least this Juvederm product will do that in skin. Like if it gets injected in your lips or into your skin. But you don't have anything close to the type of tensions and mechanical forces produced on your skin, unless maybe you're a boxer or something like that, you know, a mixed martial artist, and you're getting beat up, and your skin's getting blasted, that would move that stuff around. But you put this in skeletal muscle and then train it, unless you form sort of maybe a sterile abscess around it that encapsulates it there, you know, and those have been found. There's plenty of case studies of that in the science as well. I mean, MR images of you know, muscles with like all these little encapsulated sterile abscesses floating around. Eventually they burst. Yeah, people get sepsis and the whole kit and caboodle. It's not pretty. So either you've got it encapsulated some way, or for some reason, which I can't really glean from this, and not that, you know, I'm not all knowing, despite what Jordan was joking about. I can't figure out how, you know, what exactly they're saying this stuff does in particular. It's almost too much over the top. So I'm not sure why it would stay in the muscle up to 12 to 16 months if you're making that claim, if that claim has been substantiated for skin but not for muscle, because you've got a totally different tissue type, especially with the mechanical force that you produce in the muscle. So I would imagine you can squeeze a lot of it out of there just with the training session, which may be why, you know, you're having to use so much.
You know what? S2H made that same point that a lot of the research they have about Juvederm is under the skin versus we're talking about in the muscle. So
yeah,
I wonder too. Here's something I noticed, Scott. A while back on the other show, we were talking about IGF and spot enhancement with that, and we had talked about the potential of maybe if you used it post workout, you wouldn't have blood flow carrying it away quite as quickly, and it may stay in the muscle longer versus if you were to say, stick it in the bicep and then start training arms immediately, right, you're going to, you know, go systemic a lot faster, possibly a lot faster. Here's what I've noticed. If I use the Metform at night before bed, and then I go to sleep and I wake up, there's more of a stiffness in my arms and I can feel it in there. And it seems to last longer. But if I were to take it and then go to the gym a couple hours later and work out, I feel that tightness goes away immediately.
Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense, man. That's, yeah, exactly. And I think in one of the things, they don't really mention it here, I don't think, this sort of generic idea about cellular migration and et cetera, is that if you put a foreign material in there that creates a persistent stretch, then you're going to activate all the stretch mediated mechanisms that are involved with satellite cell proliferation, et cetera. That's, you know, the stretch. Oh gosh, there's some really cool literature. For instance, if you simply cast a muscle in a stretched position, in a longer position, it will atrophy very, very little compared to whether it's casted in a shortened position. So for instance, like another example, sort of a similar situation, is people with spinal cord injuries who take their antispasmodic medication, so they don't have any muscle contractions. They basically, you know, it's complete disuse. And a lot of times when they're sitting in their wheelchairs, they'll be plantar flexed at the ankle. So what you find is all the calf muscles atrophy tremendously because they've been shortened.
No kidding.
And the anterior tibialis doesn't, compared to able-bodied control individuals who can walk around, there's hardly any atrophy there at all. So that's just one example of how stretch can be an important mediator of at least preventing atrophy. So injecting something like in there that creates stretch in a certain area of the muscle would lead to an increase in muscle size in those areas of the muscle. Long term. It would make sense that, yeah, long term, right? So you have to kind of maintain, you know, that stretch, which is, you know, I think what I have no experience with the SEOs really at all. I always just defer on that topic because I haven't used them. But, you know, that's kind of the idea, is that you run the risk. On one hand, you want this stuff to stay there as long as possible, because that creates a persistent stretch stimulus. And on the other hand, the longer something sits there in the muscle and doesn't move, like 12 to 16 months, you know, the more potential you have for it causing an issue in terms of infection, or just, you know, even an immunity reaction, or your body's smart. It's like, well, what is this? You know, we're going to cordon this off and encapsulate it in scar tissue because this is just not supposed to be here. So it's just like a lot of stuff with bodybuilding. You're taking a risk, and you're trying to, you know, do something that, you know, you don't know what might be the risk 5 years down the road, or even 5 months down the road. But so, yeah, I think if your idea is to sort of stretch the area where the injection is put, that, then you want it to stay there.
Yeah.
You got the right idea with doing it after training.
That sounds interesting. You know, one final thing I'll note is Juvederm itself is much more expensive. Like one to two shots may cost $400 to $600. So as far as how strong this is compared to that, you know, I'm not sure. You know, that's something that I'm not sure with. I'm sure we could probably find that information out. And once again, you know, I want to say too, I'm not disparaging the product whatsoever. I don't have an opinion yet. I'm still experimenting with it. So this is, by no means am I knocking it, but I'm also still not supporting it either.
Yeah, and I'm just seeing this is just what I say. It's like, I would love, and if they could make their website so much more impressive to me if they just put some references here so you can see what they're talking about. But it's just my scientific mind says, okay, you gotta prove some of this stuff to me or demonstrate it in some way.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, we're at an hour and 20 minutes. We obviously have all of White Ox's questions and a handful after that. Do you guys want to stop here, and we should probably come up with a plan too on how to take questions, because if we aren't doing this all the time, I imagine we'd get so many questions we will never answer all of them. And Scott, I would hate for you to prepare for every question that comes on the board if we don't answer them.
Well, I learn something each time, but yeah, it can get large.
Yeah.
we could, I don't know, if we just did a cutoff, like, you know, we could just keep the stream going and then, you know, say, we're going to take these 10 questions, you know, and just let them keep filling out the, and we'll take some, we won't take others. And then we just decide like 3 or 4 days beforehand. So, you know.
Do you guys want to cut it off here or do you want to answer some of White Ox's stuff?
I'm easy.
Yeah, I can keep going if we want.
All right, we could do, what, maybe 10 more minutes on his stuff or something and then call it a day?
Okay.
All right. All right, next question's here, and this is from one of our board members, White Ox. Thank you, sir. He submitted a ton of questions. I'm sure you guys have both seen them now. This is right when we got the board started, and once we put the Q&A up, he hammered us with like 20 questions. So I think his intention was to try to help us out to get us going. So if that was the case, I definitely appreciate it. But I do want to add too, though, that we might not be able to get to all of these. In your experience, have you found the range of maximal recoverable volume to be someone training each body part 2 times a week for the distinct muscle groups? What do you think about this one, Jordan?
I'm not really sure where the phrase maximal recoverable volume cropped up from. But that would then take into consideration the idea that there is benefits from doing more volume than less volume, which I'm not certain of, and I'm not necessarily disputing either. I'm not sure whether there is a dose response to volume per training session.
Hmm.
By that I mean, is there a minimum amount of volume you need to elicit a hypertrophy? And then is doing slightly more of benefit or doing slightly more impede your recovery capabilities to training that body part at twice a week frequency? From my own experience at twice a week frequency, I have noticed, for example, 7 sets for my quads to be more beneficial than 4. So in that sense, I could, with myself, X being 1, say that I have a dose response to volume with my quads per training session.
Hmm.
And then the maximum volume that I could recover from might then only be 8 or 9 sets for quads when training at twice a week volume. I think this is an interesting idea, and it's an idea that when you're talking about it in terms of definites, needs researching way more. Because there isn't much research available. There's only a few guys doing work on this at the moment. I think if Scott was back in academia and researching this topic right now, he would kill these guys putting content out.
Yeah.
His application far supersedes that of the guys that are putting out this content. Like, I'm fascinated by this area, and as soon as I see papers crop up, I read it, and I just sit, half the time I think to myself, you don't know what real training is. And that's what troubles me with these papers. Like, you haven't done a vertical leg press till your head bleeds. You don't know. but it is an interesting topic. How do I answer this? Try it and see. Do a little bit more volume. If you feel that's beneficial, if you feel it doesn't impede your recovery, monitor the rates of growth and go with it. If you find your logbooks slowing down at your rate of progress, it could well be that you're training over your, quote, maximal recoverable volume and reduce your volume somewhat. But this is all still going to always be underpinned by intensity. And I'm interested to see what Scott's view on this is.
This is a fun one. So this idea, I got tagged on something, I think on this in the last month or so, A guy by the name of Mike Israetel, I think I'm saying that right, is Dr. Mike Israetel is the one who's proffered this notion of max recoverable volume. And his basic idea is that, yeah, there's a dose response in that there's sort of a minimum effective dose, and with each in terms of number of sets or volume, and with each increment in volume, you get a lesser reward from that. So the amount of adaptation that's brought on, and I think he talks about this in terms of strength, and we're obviously going to focus on it in terms of muscle growth, and that at some point in time, you would reach a volume of training, and I think this could be addressed in terms of the workout, in terms of weekly volume, which might be easier to look at it. I think that's because people typically train on a weekly schedule of some sort. That at some point you reach a volume of training that is beyond which you can adequately recover from. And you basically would only know that in that you've trained with that volume week after week, and you simply aren't making progress. So you're not recovering de facto by definition. So he asked about training each body part 2 times a week. And one thing that I haven't seen anyone address is, and maybe Mike has, I haven't followed his stuff specifically, you know, obviously he's been addressed this question, I'm sure, dozens of times, because this is his notion, he's given talks about this, is that the weekly volume, for instance, may also be somewhat a function of the frequency. So, let's say for hypothetical reasons, that someone's maximum recoverable volume would be 12 sets if they train 1 time a week. If they train twice a week, it might only be 5 sets each workout, so that's 10 sets. And if they train 3 times a week, it might be 3 sets per workout, so that's 9 sets. I wouldn't expect there to be a tremendously different number there, though, but the thing you have to factor into that, which makes this all so complex, is, you know, all these training variables of volume and frequency are interrelated. And I personally think that higher frequency training, and the data seems to substantiate this. Red Schoenfeld's done some of this work, and if you look at reviews of literature that have been done too, higher frequency tends to be something that makes more sense. And I've gone to that in my book, and I think we've talked about it on the podcast in the past. So the bottom line, though, above and beyond all those sort of those influences, is the individual makes a gigantic difference. And whether you can do a vertical leg press until your head bleeds makes a difference. We talked about this earlier today. So whereas one person might be able to do a certain quote-unquote volume of training, and you could even look at that, you know, in terms of a workload relative to their 1 rep max for those various exercises. So thinking here specifically of a situation where someone, you know, trains with 70 or 80% of their 1 rep max, some people might do those sets till they're bleeding from their head. Till they're about, you know, till they're getting dizzy, until they pass out, maybe they shit themselves a little bit, whatever it may be, they may be pushing that hard. The volume that they can recover from is going to dramatically differ from someone who leaves 1 or 2 or 3 or maybe 4 reps in the tank. How many times have you seen people go in the gym and train, and you know they just start to get into where their rep speed would slow down, which is indicative of fatigue? And then they stop.
Yeah.
Well, that person could do 15 sets that way, you know, probably a couple times a week. So some of that depends on just how hard the person can push. And I see this with fortitude training. It's a 3 or 4 time per week system. Most people do the 3 time per week. That's the frequency direct training for everything except for arms, essentially, and abs. And I've got 3 volume tiers, and some people can handle various amounts. So there's a substantial difference between the first and the third one. A lot of that comes down to how hard someone trains, but not necessarily. Some people just have better recovery abilities. It may be the supplements that they're using. It may be the rest of their lifestyle, whether they're eating enough food or not eating enough food. All the factors that fit into recovery are going to shift this variable. So it's not as if MRV or maximum recoverable volume is a static variable. It's not a constant. It's going to change, and it's not a constant. It's not a universal constant like the speed of light. It's going to change for every individual person. And it's also going to change depending on the exercises you do, too. Yeah. So, you know, like some people, this is the thing I've talked about, too. It's really interesting to see how I see so many people doing face pulls and, like, you know, like unilateral delt side laterals, like grabbing the ball at the end of the cable, not even using the handle, which limits like how much you can actually pull too. I would just, you know, I would be dropping that thing all the time, trying to lift a weight that's heavy enough that makes sense. So doing a lot of these sort of isolation type exercises, and you can do a lot of those. You know, if you want to do, you know, supported rows and things like that, you can do maybe two or three sets compared to doing one set of rack deads till, you know, you're starting to see stars. So the volume is going to be dependent upon that. So it's something definitely, I think, conceptually speaking, it's something to consider. You can use their perceived recovery scales. There's actually a perceived recovery scale that's in the literature now, originally introduced, which you can use to kind of guide yourself. You basically, you know, grade on a Likert scale how well recovered you feel. And you could probably kind of tune in for your particular circumstance, where you are in prep or off-season, in-season, post-contest, where your diet is, where your life stress is, all those other factors, and kind of figure out what your max recoverable volume is, as well as what's happening with the good old logbook. If you use a logbook and you see that your weights aren't moving in some way, shape, or form, and or your body weight's not moving, if you're trying to gain weight specifically, then you probably have exceeded your maximal recoverable volume. So it's giving, I like to give, it's a shorthand for something that's encapsulated, I think, in many other ways. So you can use that term without a doubt, and it makes sense. But I wouldn't latch onto it too much because, you know, you can figure out what your recoverable volume is just simply by whether you're making progress. Black and white terms. So
that makes sense. Well, it looks like White Ox, I am sorry, but we ran out of time. We got through your first question, though.
You know, one other thing, too, about research is an interesting, I believe it was a meta-analysis that Brad Schoenfeld, again, is the first name on, and he... He commented on this. They find like kind of a dose response in terms of muscle hypertrophy up to about 10 sets a week in the muscles that they tested. I think it might have been quadriceps. I can't recall exactly now. But they didn't necessarily find that was specifically a plateau. They weren't able to test beyond that and find that this was sort of an optimal point for creating muscle growth. Just up until that point, there were incremental increases in muscle growth when training with that number of sets. But again, like Jordan said, you know, there's so much variability in individuals. And then I didn't even mention this. There's set types too. That's assuming everyone does straight sets. You know, what if you're doing cluster sets like muscle rounds or dog crap training rest pause sets?
Yeah,
that's a whole other animal. How do you count those? So then you can't. Then you have to sort of throw away, because that just becomes like, you know, a gigantic, pardon my French, a kind of a clusterfuck of a regression equation if you're going to try to toss all those into the mix. So it comes down to whether you're making progress. Sorry, I just wanted to add that and give so people want to look into, they can find that paper by Schoenfeld.
No, for sure, for sure. Well, guys, this is it. How did we do for our first show?
It was fun.
Very well, I believe.
Jordan, you had some problems getting here today. The roads were terrible, but you still made it. And Scott, it was great to have you. This is I'm glad that we're back.
Yeah, me too.
Very much.
So, guys, if you didn't go yet, check out fortitudetraining.net for Dr. Scott Stevenson and trainedbyjp.com to check out Jordan Peters. For Muscle Minds, I'm Scott McNally with Jordan Peters and Dr. Scott Stevenson. This has been episode 1, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks, guys.